Bitcoin changed my life once. Watch how it changes my life for a second time. Like, it can change your life more than once in just one lifetime.
Bitcoin, by virtue of its scarcity and the freedom that it brings, gives you back the time and hopefully the capacity and energy to slow down and do everything in your life.
But I like the idea that I can just like walk around, see something in society that's broken, and just point a Bitcoin lottery at it and say, let's raise some funds for it. Maybe you'll be a lucky winner. We'll have a bit of fun.
I imagine for like a bunch of guys hanging out with their friends and like they haven't been able to get them orange pilled. It's like I'm telling you to like put a couple bucks into the lottery. Like that's a way cooler way of, you know, than, hey, read the Bitcoin Standard. Start reading Rothbard, right?
You take your money, you put your Bitcoin into cold storage and you save it. You don't need to pay a financial advisor any percentage of your wealth to do that, because Satoshi made saving for your future so simple.
Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have my good friend Rick Messett, who used to work with us here at the Bitcoin Way. Awesome guy. He's working now on an amazing project that you're going to want to hear about. We get into his backstory, which I think you really need to understand to recognize the significance of how far he has come, what he has done, and what he is doing. Like, this is going to have a major impact on the world when it goes viral and mainstream. You're going to love this episode. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I have my good friend Rick Messett here. Rick, welcome back to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Yeah, it's good to see you again, man. Like, we had some fun on Bitcoin Banter just a couple of days ago. And yeah, man, it almost doesn't feel like a podcast, right? I'm just like catching up with my mate Michael. So we'll have some fun, have a good chat. Yeah, it's great to be here.
I'm looking forward to it. These are always fun conversations you and I have. So I wanted to just start at the beginning. I think people need to understand your story, because where you are today, what you're working on, the project that we're going to get to, which everyone stay tuned for that. It's very exciting, very cool stuff. I think will make a lot more sense as you get to that story if people understood, you know, where you came from. So you were very early in discovering Bitcoin. Why don't you talk a little bit about how it came about? And you've talked, by the way, you've talked about your dad a lot with you filled me in. I had the chance to meet him in Prague, but I know he sort of planted early seeds for you as a technical guy, and also sort of philosophically that probably lended, you toward Bitcoin. So I'd be just curious to hear sort of the origin story.
Yeah, what can I say? I mean, you know, we were really lucky, right? Or I should say I was really lucky, because like you say, my dad's a software engineer, has been his whole life. He started life actually working for the banks, bizarrely enough, with these giant mainframes and check sorting machines and stuff like that. I think he started life on IBM 360 assembler. So, you know, we're going way, way back. And he's an interesting guy, right? Like, he basically thinks in binary. Like, he understands how computers work and how they think on a very sort of fundamental level. And since then, you know, he's been building in C++. The project we just built, he just taught himself a brand new programming language so that he could build that, because he thought it was a better language. So, yeah, I mean, look, if I could get 20% of my dad's intellect, I'd be doing quite well. We found Bitcoin because even when I was younger, he was explaining to me, you know, the central banking scam. So I wouldn't call him a gold bug, but he was interested in hard assets, because he'd sat down and thought, hang on, this money problem just doesn't make any sense. I guess because he's quite a logical thinker, he sat and figured out, well, hang on, if you just print money forever, this doesn't add up, right? It's not intrinsically linked to any sort of real value. So we started from a place where he already understood the problem with money, right? And then, because he can read code as well, when Bitcoin came along, he just took to it really, really, really fast, right? Because you've probably come across people like this as well, that are very talented technically, right? Developers. But if they don't understand the problem that Bitcoin's fixing, then they go off on all sorts of weird and wonderful tangents. And typically they'll end up building on Ethereum or launching some stupid shitcoin, right? Because they think it's just a technical endeavor that they're embarking on, rather than understanding the fundamental problem. And if you don't understand the problem, you won't understand the solution. So right place, right time, right interests. So we didn't like banks already. He could understand Bitcoin. And I must be a rare person on the planet, right? Because how many millennials are orange-pilled by their dad instead of the other way around, right? It's kind of bizarre. And when we found it, man, I it was crazy, right? Like, I still remember now, like, pacing the floor of my room. You know, I'd already moved out of home, but we spent hours on the phone just like, what does it mean? What does it mean? How does it work? You know, this is crazy. Like, we can win. Oh, my God, you know. So yeah, that's how we got into it. And man, we just ran down the rabbit hole so hard, so fast. Typical Bitcoiners, right? Completely obsessive, trying to learn everything we could about it. And that's where we started. Yeah.
So how long were you, what year was that you first heard about Bitcoin, got when that conviction began to run deep? And then how long were you hodling?
So back in 2013 is when we bought our first coin. So I try and remember now, like, what we paid for them. It was definitely under $100 a coin, right, when we found Bitcoin. So, yeah, crazy. And it's hard to really explain to people how speculative it was back then, because it looks really obvious now, right? And it's worth $100,000, and Larry Fink's buying it, and Michael Saylor's on a podcast every other 10 minutes, right? So now it's almost like relatively de-risked, right? There's serious players and serious value. But back then it was, I don't know, man, it felt like some weird niche project on a weird corner of the internet. Nobody was talking about it. So I wouldn't say that we had like absolute conviction on day one. That wouldn't be fair to say, right? And we wouldn't claim it. We thought it was a fascinating project and we thought maybe it's got legs. But I'm sure a lot of other Bitcoiners at the time felt the same way. Like, you know, I don't know, something will kill it. Something will happen. Something will go wrong. But that didn't stop it being any less interesting. So I couldn't tell you, like, we bought it in 2013 thinking, oh, man, by 2025, it's going to be worth $100,000, right? Like, we were like everyone else. We were like, oh, man, imagine it goes to $100. And then, oh, imagine it goes to $1,000. So it's quite surreal, like, looking back on that now and seeing just how far we've come, and your conviction grows over time. You know, it was a masterpiece when we first found it, and it hasn't changed a lot since then. It's still a masterpiece now, but the longer you play with it and the further down the rabbit hole you go, the more appreciation you get. So just like everyone else, we didn't understand it fully right off the bat, but we started in a good place with a good foundation, and yeah, turns out it was a great project and it's still going today. So yeah, wild.
So how have things changed? I don't want to sidetrack us too much because there are a lot of things I want to get to, but like you tend to like find yourself in these moments where like right now everyone's talking about treasury companies or Knots versus Core. Like there's like a handful of, and it seems like the those topical things have, you know, they go back to the beginning. My sense is that in 2013, though, it was probably much more technical stuff. It was, you know, because it was a lot of developers, cypherpunk types who were, you know, trying to figure out, like, how do we really get this thing off the ground? Like, yes, it's launched. Yes, it's in the wild. But, you know, how do we sort of move the ball forward, I guess? And then you've seen Mt. Gox, and you were there when I was, you know, when I was getting into Bitcoin in 2022, when everything was collapsing. Like, what's been the evolution in your mind of like the conversation around Bitcoin?
It was beautiful back then, man, purely for the reason that it was like 100% signal almost, right? Because when we found Bitcoin, Vitalik and all that shit hadn't shown up yet. So there was no, like, you didn't have to pass all of this other nonsense first before you could just study Bitcoin. So we were really lucky that it was the only game in town. It was the only thing worth studying. So all of the content was educational. All of the content was trying to like lead you down the path. Whereas now I feel sorry a little bit for people coming into Bitcoin, or dare I say it, crypto now, because, man, you know, I think if I came to it today, the first problem you've got is there's, you know, 10,000 coins, there's scammers everywhere, there's loads of misinformation, and actually quite a lot of influencers who are just talking about the value, like how much money are you going to make and what's it going to be worth in the future. Whereas back then, it was much more a discussion around freedom, right? Like we love the idea that I can transact without a bank in the middle. I love the idea that not everything we're going to do requires permission. So all the conversation was around that, the value thing. We would talk about it, of course, but yeah, there was so little noise compared to now. It's so noisy now. It's unbelievable. And actually, what is quite interesting is a lot of the content that's, I'm not saying it's bad content, there's a lot of great content today, but a lot of it is just recycled, right? Like you know, a lot of, I've seen so many influencers come and go over the years. That's something that happens a lot. And they are just reincarnations, sort of repeating the same things. I mean, if anyone spent any time on the Bitcoin Talk forums, every new idea that's shared on Twitter today, I promise you, someone's talked about it at length on those forums 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. So it does, it will get a little repetitive over time. But the best thing was, it was cypherpunks and anarchists and people who just didn't like the government, wanted to be free. Whereas there's a lot of people here now just trying to make a quick buck. And for some bizarre reason, still measuring value in dollars, which is bonkers to me, right? You know, you're measuring the value of a superior form of money with an inferior form of money. It's kind of like investing in laptops to try and get more typewriters, right? Or investing in light bulbs to get more candles. You know, there seems to be this hurdle of getting over seeing Bitcoin as a speculative asset and realizing, like, guys, it's actually way more simple than that. It is just better money, and you better upgrade to it in the way that, you know, hundreds of years ago, if you were using shells as money, well, when the lab showed up with some gold coins, you had to quickly figure out that maybe the shells isn't where you wanted to stay anymore. So, it's been an interesting journey, and I wish people could go back and experience what it was like when it was easier to learn about it.
Yeah, that's how I feel, because I look at some of the, like Andreas Antonopoulos was not my the conduit for me to make my way into Bitcoin. And I hear people who have been around longer talking about him as an example of just like a great orator and someone to go focus on, like his old videos for Signal. And so I went back recently and watched a few of them, and I was like, this is exactly what no one is talking about anymore. And this is all that we're sitting here struggling to Orangeville friends and family, you know, and it's like, well, no wonder it's so hard, because every podcast, almost anything you can send to them, there's like some of that signal still exists. And if they happen to find that little nugget, then great. But there's so much noise. I mean, it's like we've completely lost sight of what the overall importance of this movement and this project and this peaceful revolution is, in my view. And it's I was actually thinking about it this morning, because we've seen tons of price action in gold, right? This year, like gold's been, you know, hitting all time highs and everything. And so the gold bugs right now, they're out on Twitter, you know, bashing, you know, Bitcoiners and talking about like these short term dollar denominated price movements. And Bitcoiners are calling them out on it, or, you know, just bantering with them. And I know what's going to happen. Bitcoin's going to go to $200,000 a coin. And then Bitcoiners are going to do the same thing. They're going to say, yeah, see, we were right. It's like the central bank still exists. That's the mission. Like, let's focus on, like, glad that you have more purchasing power, but like not the mission here. Like, you know, I understand for your own personal life, that's great. But like, there's so much more work to be done. And I think that's what people just need to focus on. And it seems to me like back in 2013, there was still that, there was just still this mindset that existed that I think a lot of people wake up, work in Bitcoin all day long, think about it all day long, and that's not even on their radar any longer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you hit the nail on the head. Everyone's competing with each other, like, well, look, we made more dollar, you know, my investment is worth more in dollars. Again, we're measuring in dollars, and you're measuring in broken money, right? You know, so many people are trying to predict, well, what will Bitcoin be worth on this day or you know, some other day in the future. But to do that effectively, you're really trying to predict more than one thing. You're trying to predict, first of all, the demand and the value of Bitcoin based on, you know, how many people want to buy it, hold it, use it. But also you're trying to bet on, well, how much will the currency you're measuring in be debased? So it, for me, it's kind of a pointless task. I think the simple way to approach this is purchasing power, right? What can I get for my Bitcoin today? That's the interesting thing. And as for the gold bugs and the Bitcoiners who want to argue and debate with each other all day, again, I find it's like so short term, like this very sort of high time preference mindset, right? Because they're worried about, well, what's happened in the last 6 months. And I'm thinking, this is a paradigm shift in money and a paradigm shift in how we understand the transfer of value between people and how entire economies are going to be built. And you're busy trying to like run victory laps about slightly outperforming someone here, there, or wherever. And actually, gold pumping is really not a surprise to me, right? I wrote a newsletter a couple of weeks back about gold pumping recently and what it means. And I think all it is people are universally, Bitcoiners or not, recognizing that the dollar's cooked, right? And the central banking scam is starting to make sense to them. Now, it doesn't surprise me that for a lot of people, the first place they would run to is gold, because it's been around for thousands of years. They know what it is. They probably own some cufflinks or earrings that are made of gold. So they understand it, right? And it's maybe easier to understand. The good news for me is that they're at least calling bluff on the dollar, right? And, you know, I guess maybe what's perhaps unfortunate for these people is they might end up sitting in the wrong place, because, you know, my view is that Bitcoin is superior on quite a few metrics that we won't repeat again because everyone will have heard it, but Bitcoin is superior to gold. And I think you could be left holding the bag of gold because, you know, Bitcoin should, in theory, demonetize gold. Doesn't mean gold's got no value. You know, you can make nice jewelry with it. It's important in electronics and all that sort of stuff. But at the moment, it holds this monetary premium as the sort of debasement trade, right? If Bitcoin demonetizes gold, then yeah, it's kind of crazy how much value could flow from gold to Bitcoin. I mean, we saw gold pump by what, a few trillion dollars over this year. That's bigger than the whole market cap of gold. So again, there's another argument there to say, you know, people think that we're not early. I think, man, we're miles away from denominating the value of everything in Bitcoin. It's still extremely early. And I've stolen this from some other person who came up with this quote, right? I can't remember who. But basically, you know, Bitcoin's going to be everything divided by 21 million, right? So trying to second guess where that's going to be in terms of dollars just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that might be Knut Svanholm. I think he was maybe the originator of the everything over 21 million. Okay, so man, you talked about you were the luckiest guy. You know, your boomer dad helped introduce you to Bitcoin. He had the technical chops and sort of the philosophy to for it to resonate with him. You took to it. You had a bit of a streak of bad luck that I think is integral to the story here. Why don't you share with everyone a bit about what happened?
Yeah, I mean, we got lucky for a good 10 years, right? We were lucky to find Bitcoin when it was cheap. And then we were lucky that we never lost our money on any exchanges when they got hacked, right? Like Mt. Gox and all that. But what I would say to people is that wasn't luck. It's because we studied Bitcoin and we knew that you're meant to take self-custody. The whole point is that you don't have to leave your wealth in the hands of, you know, some trusted third party. So we avoided all of that craziness. We were lucky that we found it so early that we could study it without all the distractions and shitcoins and NFTs and all that. So again, we managed to swerve all of that bullshit on our 10-year journey. And, you know, we continued to get lucky like that because we put the work in. But as you say, unfortunately, we did hit a spot of bad luck because, oh man, it's a wild story. But after 10 years of hodling, you know, we were pretty happy with the returns, you know, and we were doing quite well, pleased with what we'd done. We decided, come on, let's go on a father-son trip of a lifetime. We'll go to El Salvador, right? And see what's going on over there. And off we went. Having a great time, Bitcoin Beach, all this good stuff. We went to Adopting Bitcoin, the conference over there. And man, honestly, it feels like some sort of surreal, like Netflix episode that we lived through, because on the last night of the conference, you know what it's like going to a Bitcoin conference, right? You're like full of energy, all pumped up. And we've been working on a little project together for a little while on Bitcoin. So we were like, we rushed home to our Airbnb, opened our laptops up. We said, right, we're going to test this thing that we've been building. And we went to go and move some funds, move them to Lightning and make some transactions. And oh man, I don't know how to describe it, but you know, I was making like a cup of tea or something, typical Englishman, right? Making a cup of tea. And my dad's like sitting at his laptop and he just, I mean, you know, I don't want to swear all over your podcast, but he just went, fuck. And I was like, yo, were you okay? What happened? You know, like maybe stubbed his toe or spilled a drink or so, I don't know. And then he just says, like, we've been hacked. Like the Bitcoin's gone. And it was just, oh man, it's hard to explain. Like, obviously it's like every Bitcoiner's worst fear, right? And the world just like, man, your heart rate goes up, the adrenaline, like you're shaking and like kind of just really, really surreal. And then you very quickly get into the bargaining phase. So, you know, my dad was like, oh, hang on. I did change my laptop recently. Not that this would be particularly relevant, but obviously in the moment, your head is all over the shop. And he's like, maybe, you know, maybe I made some backups. I transferred some things around. Like maybe there's some silly explanation as to like why I'm looking in the wrong wallet or why the balance is zero, whatever. So, you know, he was wrestling with that for a bit. And I'm just sort of sitting on the couch, like my mind just spinning. I just said, oh, Dad, look, are there any transaction IDs? And so he pings me one. I put it into a Block Explorer. And that's when it really hit home, because I just saw, man, so many transactions. This Bitcoin just went boof, you know, into thousands of transactions. You could see that it was getting mixed and coin joined as well. And as soon as I saw that, I knew for absolute certain, like, no, this is no mistake, right? Someone's got in here, someone's got the Bitcoin and it's gone. And then you just have this weird, like forced acceptance. Like you know it's gone. We know well enough how Bitcoin works. There's no one to call, right? I can't call Satoshi. And even if I could, he couldn't do anything about it. There's no CEO, there's no support sort of network there. So what can I say? We're in the middle of El Salvador, supposedly on this amazing sort of celebratory trip. And your world just falls apart. It's a visceral experience, man. I mean, you know, 10 years of delayed gratification, right? Like I'm a really frugal person. So is my dad. And, you know, I was willing to delay my gratification, didn't really spend much Bitcoin along the way because, you know, I knew where it would ideally be taking us and what it could mean for our family and stuff like that. And to lose all of that in one, you know, seemingly like just in an instant is crazy. Your brain goes to weird places, you know. I was away to get married in a couple of months. I'm like, shit, right? Now I've got to call my fiance and explain, I'm flat broke. Like everything's gone. Like I don't know what we're going to do next. It felt kind of like, you know, I've been holding this since I was like 24, so it's 25, something like that, you know, and you just think, God, man, like so much time has passed. I'll never get that opportunity again. It was a swift kick in the nuts. Yeah.
Gosh, man, I can't even imagine. And to imagine like that, because you and I have talked about this. We talked about it on the first time you joined the podcast. We've obviously talked about it in person, but like to try imagining that moment, you know, not just like the aftermath and the fallout, but like almost like the panic of did this just really happen? I can't even imagine. I don't think it would be. So can you, I think you need to probably elaborate a little bit on like what went wrong, because I think at the Bitcoin way, this is what we help people do. And I think it's just important that as we talk about this, we don't scare people away from self-custody because it doesn't have to be complicated. It's something that everyone can achieve. I think there were some mistakes that were made that you would just say, hey, these are the red flags of self-custody. Here's maybe a better approach.
Yeah, man, listen, you know, one thing I've learned in life is that if you make a mistake, just own it. Just take the L, right? Take the L and accept that you made some mistakes, and we did, right? So, you know, we made so many good choices along the way, right? We didn't lose our money when Mt. Gox got hacked because we took self-custody. We didn't lose our money to shitcoins because we studied Bitcoin and we knew better. And we didn't get shaken out by any bear markets because we understood the value that we held. But the mistake we made is, we got complacent is the simple answer. So we took self-custody, but over the years, as better tools and better approaches to self-custody came out, we just didn't update and we just didn't upgrade, right? And, you know, I think about this a lot, like, why didn't we? And I think part of the reason is, you know, you hold something for 10 years like that and nothing goes wrong. you fall into this sense of security, right? Like, oh, you know, and man, listen, over those years, I'd heard loads of people getting hacked in various different ways. And you just think, no, you know, we're in a good spot. We know what we're doing and that sort of thing. So let's get into the details of the mistake, right? So we took self-custody, right? Which meant we had our own seed words. And back then there was no metal plates. I mean, not that you couldn't do it yourself, but you know, metal plates weren't really a thing. Hardware wallets weren't really a thing. So we made our own way up of taking self-custody. So what we did is we knew better than to like save this seed on some centralized service. So we took a piece of software, which by the way, is a great piece of software. I don't want to put anyone off this software either. We use something called KeePass, which is basically a password manager. Now, it's really important I make the distinction. This wasn't like LastPass, right? Which is like a centralized service that holds your passwords for you. KeePass is like a sovereign version of that, right? So it's your own password manager. It's open source software, and you hold the file that contains all the passwords, right? So our seed goes inside of this KeePass file, which we also did encrypt, right? So even if you had the KeePass file, if you didn't have the password to it, you wouldn't be able to get into it. You wouldn't get to the seed. But then comes another problem, which you'll be aware of, which is, well, how do you back this up? Because if you have this file on a computer and that computer dies or something goes wrong with the hard drive, you need to have more copies of it so you can access it somewhere else. Now, you know, I think at that point, my dad kind of reverted to type, right? He's a software engineer. He understands that you have to back things up and build redundancy. So he then stored this KeePass file in the cloud, which we all know now, never, ever, ever store seeds or anything related to Bitcoin on the cloud. But having said that, obviously the cloud is password protected. The file itself that had the seed in is encrypted. So yeah, it wouldn't have been the easiest thing to hack and get into. So that was our setup, right? Seed phrase in a KeePass file, that KeePass file backed up to the cloud. And I couldn't tell you exactly the method that, that the hackers used, but I can say with some confidence, I think I know what happened. So what we found out later when we dealt with the police who were helping us with this is that our details were lost at Mt. Gox. So we bought the coins on Mt. Gox. Mt. Gox got hacked and we were thinking we're sitting pretty. We took self-custody, so we didn't lose any money. But what never crossed my mind at the time was when Mt. Gox was hacked, they also stole all of the KYC data, right? And what I learned from the police is they said, you do realize, guys, that your both your names, your home addresses, every single Bitcoin transaction you ever made out of the exchange, that was all stolen too. And by the way, it's all for sale on the dark web. Now that will scare the life out of you, right? Because you realize at that point that we were hacked, but man, someone could have showed up at my dad's house with that information and made a physical attack. This is why KYC is so damn dangerous. So what we think happened is someone armed with this KYC data from Mt. Gox recognized that me and my dad were a reasonable target to go after, right? We had a decent stack of Bitcoin. It was worth the effort. And then basically what they've done is they've brute forced their way into my dad's cloud storage, and then they've brute forced their way into this KeePass file as well. So the critical mistake, I mean, look, you should never have a setup like that anyway, now that we have better tools like hardware wallets and steel plates. But the real, real clanger of a mistake is that the password used to encrypt the cloud storage and encrypt the KeePass file was way too weak. And I mean, I won't tell you what the password was, but it was laughably weak. I mean, we're talking like 35 bits of entropy, right? So, I mean, look, you know, the guy who hacked it, I think a script kiddie with some brute force software that they downloaded off the dark web could have done this. It wouldn't have taken a shadowy supercoder to get in. So I guess it was a combination of, you know, our KYC data flowing around everywhere, weak passwords when we were encrypting things to store seeds. And they came after us, they got in and they wiped the lot as well. I mean, I speak to my wife about this and she's like, look, Rick, you clearly don't understand criminals. Because I say things like, man, could they not have left like even $500 right, worth of Bitcoin? And she said, Rick, you just don't understand how these people think, right? They don't have any compassion. If they're capable of stealing from you, they will take every single Satoshi. I mean, they could have left us a coffee or something, but no, I guess they're total assholes, right? So yeah, we got completely wiped out. And that was back in November 2023. And look, this is why Bitcoin's a great investment, but it's only an investment. Hate calling it an investment, but it's only a place you should store your wealth if you are willing to learn the skills. If you're not willing to take full responsibility and really look after this stuff and put the time in, put the effort in, you maybe shouldn't touch it, because it's not for people who are not ready for that responsibility, because you probably get yourself in trouble. Like, if you're going to buy Bitcoin, the very next thing you have to do is learn how to secure it properly, learn how to use it properly. You can't go halfway. And actually, this is what I see a lot of people doing, because they're just here for the gains, just for the making the money. They kind of just ignore all the, oh, that bit's boring, right? Like, is my coin pumping? Am I making money? And they get distracted from going. They get to stage 5 of 10 and they really need to walk the whole path, because you're only going to get lucky with Bitcoin if you hold it long enough. And you're only going to hold it long enough if you know how to keep it secure. So, well, I mean, look at, you know, I don't want to shill the company on the podcast, but man, like, if you're no good at this stuff, like, if you're putting a significant amount of money into Bitcoin, spend some money to get someone to train you how to look after it. Like, it's just such a no-brainer. And if I could go back in time, man, I'd give Tony half my stack to keep the rest of it, right? So that's the learning.
Yeah. There's like this, I think this is one of those underappreciated decays that we've seen from fiat. And it's that people, we don't take responsibility for almost like everything in our lives is effectively outsourced, except quite literally like our day job. I mean, even now we've got people using Klarna to buy DoorDash. And so it's like you're using someone else's money that you'll pay back later to buy food that you didn't prepare. You know, and we have to like reorient ourselves to this notion of personal responsibility. Even people who like, you know, you talk to and you're like, yeah, they seem like a responsible adult. They on average don't have the curiosity to do what you're describing here. And I think the most frustrating thing is it's not that complicated. It's just a matter of taking the time to learn. And I think for me, this is one of those things that I'm saying this and I could point to you at aspects of my life where I'm not living up to that. And I'm not, self-custody is not one of them. That is something I now take very seriously as I've learned and my conviction in Bitcoin has grown. But I think there's like an overarching theme to this. It's not just Bitcoin self-custody. That is crucial if you're going to store your wealth in Bitcoin. But to begin taking responsibility for all aspects of your life. And I would also add that Bitcoin, by virtue of its scarcity and the freedom that it brings, gives you back the time and hopefully the capacity and energy to slow down and take a low time preference approach to how you do everything in your life, including secure your wealth. So that's sort of an aside. I don't know if you have any comment on that, but I think it's like a lost art of responsibility that we have.
I think you bang on the money, right? I think one of the reasons, you know, like, man, week in, week out, what are we talking about all the time? And what do I write in the newsletter constantly is about counterparty risk, right? Because people are buying Bitcoin and then they're leaving it on an exchange. And I think you're absolutely right. This is like a hangover from a fiat system that doesn't require you to take responsibility. Because like, and I'm sure it's the same in the US, but in the UK, right? The FCA will backstop any bank failures. So, you know, up to 85 grand in your bank account, if the bank goes pop, the government will just bail you out, give you your money back and socialize the losses. So I think most people underestimate counterparty risk or don't even really think about it at all because they've always been protected from it. It's almost like, it's like a prey animal that's never seen a predator, right? Have you seen that meme where there's like a cheetah with his paw on top of a deer and the deer is not running away because it obviously doesn't recognize the threat. So because they've had this safety net underneath them forever and they always keep getting bailed out, they take that same mindset to Bitcoin, But they don't realize, like, you know, if FTX blows up, Mt. Gox blows up, or, I mean, you know, ticking time bomb, Coinbase blows up, no one can bail you out because the government can't print more Bitcoin. The exchange can't print more Bitcoin. Once it's gone, it's gone. So, you know, I think a lot of people are going to get a savage lesson in counterparty risk because they've never experienced it before. And I just hope we can reach enough people to explain this to them before they find out the hard way, right?
Yeah, it's so hard to bridge that gap because everything most people are doing on a day-to-day basis involves immense counterparty risk, you know? And like even shopping at the grocery store, like you are that is, I'm not saying everyone needs to grow their own food, but everyone is you're reliant on this third party, and you better hope that those shelves are stocked when you go in and you need food. And that's why, like in my personal life, again, I'm not there. Like I've got progress to go, but I'm trying to find people who I can meet, local farmers, folks who can provide me value that I can actually have a personal relationship with, because I want to be the first one that they seek to help when, you know, my time of need comes. And then if I can pay them in the hardest money ever to exist, they're going to see that as a value that I'm providing them. And there's like the circular economy, I think it's become like almost a meme, like, oh, like we're building circular economies. And I think the value of it extends to like this core essence of what it means to be human. And most people think, well, it's just, you know, some way for me to be able to spend the Bitcoins. Like, no. Like this is, we talk about trustlessness and, you know, it's like, no. We need trust, just not in our money, not in our Bitcoin. We need trust in our personal lives, though. And you can't do that with counterparties, to your point.
Well, man, like, you're taking me right back to 2013, because this is all we were talking about. All I've ever wanted is to just trade with people without anybody's permission. Like if you start selling really good chicken or eggs or something, I want to be able to come up to you and go, Michael, I want to buy some eggs. And I don't need anyone else to participate in that. So yeah, that's what it's all about, is the freedom. You know, money is just a tool. It always has been, in whatever format it is. It's always just a tool to communicate value over a network between people so that we can trade without having to rely on barter, which is inefficient. That's all it is. And I just want a perfect form of that that nobody can mess with. And that's the signal. That is the signal.
Yeah, it really is. And it doesn't need to be much more complicated than that. The lift that emerges when you're trying to get people to understand this is it's the same analogy I always use. It's not mine, but it's the fish in water. Like they have no concept of water. Like their environment is so, it feels so natural that it wouldn't even occur to them that water was this even a substance. And it's the same thing. Well, you have to use a bank. You have to have go to the doctor. You have to have health insurance. You have to have all of these things. And the minute you begin to question what's optional is the moment that you realize I've just been sold a lie in like 50 major areas of my life. I can choose selectively to opt into those things where I find them to be valuable and opt out where I don't want a counterparty. I don't want to rely on someone else. I mean, the do your own research meme that emerged during COVID, I mean, spot on. Like whatever the topic, just do your own research. And I promise you, with today's tools to do some of your own research, you will come to a better conclusion very quickly than if you just accept the mainstream conventional wisdom that's being spoon-fed to us every day. So anyway, dude, I took us way off track. So the hack, you gave some good prudent advice. You had quite a comeback to all of this. So talk about speaking in Prague. I'd love to hear you talk about joining the Bitcoin Way, working with us, and just everything that's transpired since. And then we need to get to the project that you're working on.
Yeah, oh man. I mean, you know, I look back now, it's been a couple of years since then. And if you'd asked me, you know, how would you respond to this happening before it happened? I don't know what I would have said, right? But I would have been worried that I'd be severely broken. And, you know, for a little bit I was, you know, that was a real hard punch to take. But the best decision I made throughout any of this was I was sitting outside. There's this really, I hate watching it back. There's a video of me in El Salvador, like explaining to everyone what had happened. And I shared it on Twitter. And I couldn't tell you what made me do that. Just random. You know, I had no one to speak to. So I just made a video on Twitter and shared it. And it just went crazy. And obviously, I got a load of people calling me an idiot and all that sort of stuff. Listen, there's no need. I'm well aware, right? It's fine. But overwhelmingly, what was the best thing is like Bitcoiners are awesome. You know, like so many people reached out with like messages of support. And, you know, there's one guy, I won't say his name. Well, I don't think I know his name, actually. I just shout out Kiwi. There's a guy, Kiwi, who, man, he spent like 6 hours just texting back and forth with me, like trying to make sure that my mindset didn't go to any bad places, trying to remind me like, look, we're at the cusp of something that, you know, is still early. There's still time, you know, don't worry, pick yourself up. And I worry, had I not shared it and I'd not had that connection with loads of other people that understood the situation and wanted to see us get back on our feet, I don't know if I would have just curled up in a ball and felt sorry for myself. So, you know, my first big appreciation and a big part of the reason I'm even here and still feeling good and happy and still, you know, in love with the whole Bitcoin thing is that so many people went out of their way to help us. And it's actually one of my favorite things about Bitcoin is Bitcoiners. They're just awesome. So, you know, the first thing I should say is just thank you to everybody, right? Like, that's the most valuable thing for Bitcoin for me is all the people that I've met along the way. Just incredible, right? Like when it happened and so many people were so good to us, I'd never experienced kindness from strangers like that in my life. It was really kind of had a profound effect on me. And I realized, you know, there was part of this. I had to bounce back and get back on my feet, not just for me, but also for them and also for my dad. I couldn't roll over and let this defeat me. You know, what impact would that have on my dad and my family? If I go down some black hole here into some, you know, pure misery and depression, actually, all I'm going to do is make things way, way worse. So, yeah, you know, bounce back from that. And one of the people who reached out was Tony. You know, Tony obviously heard my story and Tony's story is brutal as well. I guess there's probably not that many people who really have felt what it feels like to wake up one day and think I've lost everything. So, you know, Tony reached out and offered to help and stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, look, I've been an entrepreneur all my life and I'm also a storyteller, marketeer. So I think I realized at one point, like, holy shit, I've got one hell of a story to tell, right? Like, how do I leverage this to my advantage a little bit? And, you know, fair play to Tony and Andy and Ahmed. You know, I phoned them up and said, hey, guys, look, I don't know what you think about this, but you guys want to teach everyone about self-custody, right? They're like, yeah. And I said, well, I think I might be the best case study you're ever going to find about how important it is to take it seriously. And, you know, at first they don't know me from Adam, right? I could be any random guy. So they're, oh, yeah, no, okay, right? So we started off slow, you know, like I was going to some events and promoting them and stuff. And then ended up on stage at Prague to share the story. And man, it just went from there. And, you know, man, like I do back myself on the marketing thing, right? Like I've been building businesses a lot of my life, most of my life. I'm pretty resilient, pretty dogged and stuff like that. So They gave me this slither of opportunity and I was not going to miss, right? So I tried my best to put a really good talk together. And it went from there. They said, hey, Rick, do you want to be the CMO of the Bitcoin Way? I was like, man, hell yeah. You know, like I think I'd applied for some Bitcoin jobs before the hack and not really got anywhere, right? Because, I mean, crazy competitive environment to get a Bitcoin job, right? So, man, I don't know what to tell you. You know, you can... If I give someone advice, it's like if something really, really bad happens to you, like try and think like, how can I turn this steaming pile of shit to my advantage, right? Like, how can I leverage it? How can I use it? And the coolest thing was like, you know, giving that talk and again, loads of people take the piss out of me and say, oh, what an idiot, blah, blah, blah. I've got a pretty thick skin, man. I couldn't care less about that. But overwhelmingly, it was people messaging me like so many messages, man, saying, holy cow, like I've gone and bought a hardware wallet. I've gone and done this. I've gone and put my seed on metal. And I felt, hell, you know what? Like maybe I had to be the sacrifice, right? Like I had to sacrifice my coins for a lot of other people not to. And I won't get into necessarily how I know this, but, you know, a few of the connections and stuff like that that I've made for the Bitcoin Way, I know that that story has led to more Bitcoin ending up in very secure self-custody than what we lost. So I'm going to take it as a win, right? So yeah, that's how it happened. It was kind of wild, man.
Yeah, dude, your legacy is going to be the people whose lives were changed by proper self-custody and the ability to hold and transact securely and privately and without any third party bothering them. And like 20 years from now, there are going to be people who, last year or, this year heard this podcast and said, okay, enough. I need to stop keeping my coins on Coinbase. And you'll never know that like Rick Messett's story was the reason they took self-custody and then they passed on generational wealth years from now. So I think it's obviously a sad story, nothing that we ever want to see, but I think you've turned it into a beautiful thing. So kudos to you for doing so. So, hey, I watched your speech at Prague last year. It's been a while. You basically detail the story, that we've sort of described here. Is when you got off stage, what was the response? Like, were people like finding you and seeking you out to chat with you, or what was the response there?
Oh, it was crazy, man. I mean, like, I quite like public speaking, right? I get a bit of a kick out of it. Like, I've always enjoyed it throughout my whole career doing various things. But man, that one was hard, right? Because it's so emotional, so personal. Like, to get up on stage, I had to hold it together a little bit. And like, man, people were coming up to me afterwards, like, what? A couple of people were crying, right? And I was like, oh my God, don't, because you're going to set me off, right? Like, it was like, it was intense. But we got some signups. Like, people were like straight away, like, right, that's not happening to me. No way. I'm going to sign up with the Bitcoin way and get this sorted. And mainly just people, they were really kind, right? They said, man, I can't believe you went up on stage and told everyone that. And I've never had a big ego, right? I'm not like a big ego kind of guy, right? So if I've got something useful to share with other people that can help them, I don't mind if it's slightly embarrassing for me. The one thing, man, is that we've studied Bitcoin for 10 years, and I'm well aware that we are, man, Bitcoin's going to last thousands of years, or perhaps indefinitely. We're in year 16 now. It's still unfathomably early, and I understood that. So I also wanted to kind of prove the point that, like, Bitcoin changed my life once. Watch how it changes my life for a second time. Like, it can change your life more than once in just one lifetime. And I'd like to demonstrate that. So, by the way, that's not going to be me like driving a Lambo on Twitter one day going, haha, I made it again, right? But it's when you understand it's money and you can go and work hard on whatever project or whatever business you're working on, save in Bitcoin, and your life just gets better. It's just this trajectory, and it really is a cheat code. So yeah, if I can demonstrate that, like, man, you can lose your ass and still make it all again, that would be a great outcome.
Yeah. Well, hey, there was one other comeback that you forgot to mention that you had, and your hair is looking lovely today. So you got to let people know what I'm talking about here.
Yeah. Oh man. Like, I can be quite an impulsive person. Right. And one of the, oh man, yes. Like this. Yeah. After the hack, right. I've never dealt with that amount of stress in one single dose. And it's pretty tragic, man. Those times, like, if I was feeling really down, I didn't want to let people around me feel that pain. So, I'd go and hang out in the bathroom or something, and I'd be standing in the shower and I'm like washing my hair, and clumps of hair are coming out of my hand and stuff, and I'm not gonna lie to you, I'm feeling pretty sorry for myself in those moments. And just the severe stress took a toll on my body as well, right? Like, it was brutal. So randomly, I don't know how long ago this was now, but maybe a year and a half later or something, me and my wife decide we're going to go on a little trip to Turkey, right? We had a little holiday, and I'm quite impulsive. So on the last day, some people might know this about Turkey, but they're famous for doing hair transplants, right? And on the last day of the holiday, I thought, you know what? Sod it, right? Like, you can take my Bitcoin. You're not taking my fucking hairline as well, right? I just marched my way into this hair clinic and said, right, let's go. Let's get this done. And not knowing, by the way, I would not recommend that, right? Like, you should do your research. I could have ended up with a total quack and they could have totally messed up, and I got quite lucky. And 10 minutes later, I'm lying down on a I'm lying down on a bed and they're like drilling holes in your head. And I'm thinking, wow, I didn't realize. I look over, there's like a cup with a pool of my blood in it. And I probably underestimated what I'd signed myself up for. But yeah, man, like, man, I got more hair than when I was 25. Like, I'm loving it. Yeah, I would recommend.
You look good, dude. I remember you sending pictures of that. I think you told us you were going to be in Turkey or like going to be gone for a few days. You'd be in touch or whatever. Like all of a sudden you're sending us pictures of your, you know, your operation. Dude, that was a good story. Okay. So let's talk about your lottery project. This is, we were in Athens together last year and I remember there was a night, I think we were walking to like a cigar bar or something. We're going to go hang out and you and I were hanging back from the group and you started talking to me about this project and however you described it at the time, I thought this is awesome. Like, I don't really remember all the details. And, but I think this is because when you first started describing it, I thought, oh, like, you know, that's cool. Like I could see, you know, people having some fun with it. And then as you continued, it became evident that this could be something that is an incredibly useful and powerful tool for institutions, governments, I mean, everyday people, charities, nonprofits. Why don't you start with what the project is? And then I want to work through all of that because I think it's, I think I want to get people's wheels turning as they think about how could I maybe leverage something like this?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is our honey badger moment because I mentioned, you know, we learned that we got hacked when we were trying to play with this little project. And it's just our sheer principle, right? And doggedness. It was like, we have to finish that project now because otherwise the hack has taken more than our money. It's taken all of our like ambition and things that we want to do. So we finally finished it and we launched it just last week in Bulgaria, actually. And yeah, like you say, it's a provably fair Bitcoin lottery. The easiest way I could explain the idea is traditional lotteries kind of suck. Right? Because they're all completely reliant on trust. And what I mean by that is, you know, I'm sure lotteries in the US are similar to here, but they'll use like a big ball machine, right? And you select your numbers. Then they have a live feed of the ball machine. They pick out the numbers, you match the numbers and win a prize. But there is a lot of trust involved because you have to trust that the ball machine hasn't been tampered with. And you have to trust that like the balls haven't been weighted and things like that. And actually, if you go down those rabbit holes, it's a bit niche, but there's so many examples of lotteries being scammy or people like messing with the ball machines. It happens more often than you'd think. And we thought there's got to be a better way of doing this. So we had this idea, which is, well, hang on, you could probably make a lottery that's completely provably fair. Because instead of using a ball machine or a random number generator, what you can do is what if we use the hash of a future Bitcoin block to choose a winner? Because the hash of a future block, nobody can predict it. But once it's happened, everybody can verify it. So that's really where the idea began. How can you build a lottery that runs entirely on Bitcoin and doesn't interact with fiat in any way, shape, or form? So the really simple way to describe this in terms of how it works is we built a lottery where you would come to the website, right, where the lottery is hosted, and you would say, Rick, here is my Bitcoin payout address, right, which is your on-chain address. So you don't give us your name, you don't give us your address or any personally identifiable information. You just give us one of your Bitcoin addresses. Now, that's where your winnings will get paid if you're the lucky winner. Then we take that Bitcoin address and we put it in our list of entries. So if there was 100 entrants, all with a different Bitcoin address, that's what would be on the list, 100 separate Bitcoin addresses. Once we close the lottery and we stop selling tickets, we stop selling entries, then we timestamp that list of entries and share it with everyone. A little bit like Bitcoin's blockchain, right? We all have our own copy of the blockchain. Well, with a Bitcoin lottery, everybody has the same list of entrants with the Bitcoin payout addresses on, and it's timestamped so you know it won't change. Once that's happened, we basically say, right, when block 10,000 or whatever arrives, that's the winning block, and that's the hash. We will take the hash of that block to select the winner from our list of entries. And then really simply, once that hash arrives, we pick the winner and we pay out. And because everyone's got the list of entries, they're able to see that the right winner was selected, that the payout was made, and everything is completely transparent. And I think that's way better than the way lotteries work at the moment. So a traditional lottery, especially in the UK, they use it to say like, oh, we're going to fund things like building a hospital or funding education and this, that, the other. But part of the problem is that, like, when you go up and you buy a ticket, you get no say in where the money's going. The money just goes into some big, dark black hole, and you don't really know how it's distributed or spent. And you know, there's some CEO here of this lottery probably paying himself £500,000 to pick balls out of a ball machine, which seems completely ridiculous to me. They're using paper tickets, dedicated point of sale machines and terminals that cost loads of money. And the whole thing's just like horribly inefficient, relies on trust. There's a lot of people taking a lot of value out of these lotteries along the way as well. You know, like a lot of these companies that run them, they're VC-backed behemoths. For example, the company Alwyn Media is who runs the lottery in the UK. And they run, the last time I checked, at something like 46% EBITDA, right? Which means I suddenly realized, hang on, rich people don't play the lottery. They invest in the lottery because it's a profit-making machine. So they're always pushed as like, you know, this is like for the common good and we're all going to play a big game together, spend a few pounds and someone will win and loads of money will be raised for charity. But there are middlemen, again, middlemen just extracting value where they're really not needed. So we wanted to build something transparent and fair and lightweight. And yeah, hopefully that's a good explanation.
That's awesome. So give me some examples. This is where like my mind was sort of blown. So give me some examples of how could a company, or you mentioned like, you know, a government could even choose to opt for this. Like what would be the benefit to doing so? Because I think the hurdle you come like to overtake like the real lotteries that exist today is that, to your point, like there are a bunch of people getting rich off of them, and so they don't want that. But it seems like this is an unstoppable force too, much like Bitcoin, that anyone could just say, hey, screw the big guys, this is what we're going to do, and people are going to migrate to the fairer, better system, I think, over time. Like how do you anticipate or hope that this technology would be used in the real world?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, you know, another limitation of a traditional lottery is like, you know, there'll be a UK lottery, there'll be a lottery in the US, there'll be lotteries in France, Germany, all these other places, but they're trapped in their own jurisdictions. So what the government is kind of doing is raising money from their own local population to pay for things like infrastructure and so on. But I have this crazy idea in my head, like imagine, I think at the moment, don't quote me on this, but through some light research, I think I discovered that the National Lottery in El Salvador is currently run by a company out in Canada, believe it or not, right? So they have this lottery in El Salvador, and like most lotteries, I'm sure Bukele uses it to raise money to pay for hospitals and bridges and God knows what else, right, to build his country out. But the problem is he's limited to raising funds from his local population only. But imagine, well, first of all, I'd say getting a Canadian company to run your lottery means you're not as sovereign as you could be. But there's nothing stopping you from running a Bitcoin-based lottery and actually opening it up to the whole world. So now instead of just raising money from El Salvadorians to build out your infrastructure, you could build a borderless global lottery that attracts money from wealthier countries, right? And if I was Bukele, I'd think, yeah, maybe that's an interesting idea to help me build out my country, right? And again, a bit like Bitcoin, maybe there's a bit of a first mover advantage. If you're the first country to launch a Bitcoin lottery, everyone else will be playing catch up with you, right? But also, I mean, here's the fun thing about the project, man, is like we didn't make it with any real view for us to make any money from it. Or, you know, I know there's a lot of Bitcoin influencers out there that will shill you any sort of crazy project. We just wanted to do it because we thought it was cool. And I also like the idea of, man, I could give you this software, right? And you could run a little local lottery in your local town, because maybe you and everyone else in the town decide there's too many potholes in the road, the government aren't coming to fix it. Why don't we have a little local lottery? We each put a fiver in. One of us will win 30% of the funds and the other 70% will fix the roads ourselves. right? Maybe we could use that. There's also ways, I won't get into it because it's a little technical, but that you could actually give away physical prizes and things like that as well. So I just like the idea that maybe we could wrestle lotteries away from these VC-funded centralized places, make them more transparent, more fair. And hey, instead of the lottery operator deciding what to fund, what if when you bought your ticket, you got to vote on the good cause that you wanted to support with your money, and then it was distributed based on what everyone wanted to fund and support? So yeah, I have this like mad idea, right? That like, you know, we always say like Bitcoin fixes this, right? That's a common saying in Bitcoin, but it's often like really theoretical, right? Like, yeah, on a sound money standard, you know, several decades from now, maybe the food system will be fixed and this system and that system. And I agree with that. But I like the idea that I can just like walk around, see something in society that's broken, and just point a Bitcoin lottery at it and say, let's raise some funds for it. Maybe you'll be a lucky winner. We'll have a bit of fun. And try and have, like, take direct action and fix something. So that's what we did in Bulgaria, right? We took it out for a spin to see how it would work. And I didn't promote it online just because, like, it's the first time we've run the software. I think we only had about $7,000 of inbound liquidity on the Lightning Network to sell tickets. And I didn't really fancy putting this all over Twitter and it just going absolutely bonkers, you know, like, we're already taking a risk launching software on stage. That's like a golden rule. You don't do that. But it went really well, right? We sold 472 entries. I think we raised somewhere in the region of 380,000 sats. So 180,000 sats for the winner, and 180,000 sats went to the Bulgarian Bitcoin Circular Economy Initiative. Guys, please rebrand, because I can never remember that name. We're basically, they're an organization out in Bulgaria that are trying to help merchants onboard into accepting Bitcoin and all that sort of thing. So from our point of view, it's like we raised money to support the Bitcoin economy in Bulgaria. Someone won like 180 bucks worth of Bitcoin. And by the way, we didn't take any money out of that because we're not doing it for the money. We're just doing it for the culture. And yeah, one thing I'll add, right, is, and I don't want to sound disparaging, but like a lot of people will say like they're innovating in Bitcoin because they accept it as payment, right? For, I don't know, like t-shirts, hoodies, soap, you know, I've seen all sorts of things. And by the way, I should say I love that because I live on a Bitcoin standard and I want to be able to spend my Bitcoin on things. But what I think about the lottery, or why I get so excited, is because let's put it like this: taxis existed before Uber, right? But it ran on old technology. You'd have to phone someone up. The problem's the same. We're moving someone from point A to point B in a car. Uber hasn't changed that. We're still moving people from point A to point B in a car. But what Uber did is said, well, we're going to do taxis, but it can be so much better if we build it on top of better technology, i.e. the internet. And so we got so obsessed with this idea because we felt like we were kind of doing the same thing. Like lotteries exist now, and this is a lottery, the same sort of idea. But wouldn't it be so much better if it ran on Bitcoin, because it suddenly becomes like instant? You don't need point of sale machines. You don't need paper tickets, and it's completely trustless, right? You don't have to trust that the draw was fair. You can prove that it was. So just seems like an upgrade. Like, you know, we've got better money now. We can do better, cooler things with it.
I think the most compelling thing about this to me, besides obviously that it's verifiable, that you don't have to trust a centralized, you know, intermediary on any of this, is it's such an interesting point that basically anyone who's running a lottery of any kind, whether on like a commercial scale or for like a local fundraiser, is severely limited in their reach. It's highly jurisdictional, and like whether that's by law or just practically speaking, like, as I've worked with the Bitcoin way, one of the things I like most is that there's no chance I would have ever met you, you know, some guy living in Europe, and like my world is completely opened up, and now we're friends, we're, you know, hanging out, talking. Like, I don't care to do some little local lottery, you know, here in Missouri where I live. I want to do it with the people who I have something in common with, right? And like, I can only imagine if you, me, Tony, some of the guys got together and said, hey, like, what could we, like, what do we care about? Let's spin up a lottery. And then we open it up to our world of Bitcoiners who are paying attention, interested. Like, we'd have people in South Africa, Australia, Germany, Scotland, all across the US, Latin America, all joining in and doing this thing. And there's an element of that that makes it just a better solution. Like, it broadens your reach, but it's also just awesome. Like, it gives you the ability to like have these really cool projects that you begin to recognize and appreciate just how big the world is, and that you've got people on your team and for all sorts of causes everywhere. It's just like this beautiful picture of I guess what Bitcoin represents.
Yeah, and like, man, I like it for all sorts. I mean, obviously I'm biased, right? We built it, but like, I think everyone struggles to orange pill people, right? So, yeah. You know, how often have you heard someone say, oh, I'm too late to Bitcoin, it's too expensive, and you've got that hurdle, right? They're still trapped in fiat land. But what if you could say to them, well, hey, man, you don't have to buy any. Like, you can enter the Bitcoin lottery for just a dollar, and maybe you'll win some Bitcoin, right? But what's like, it's a little bit of a Trojan horse, because if they want to play the lottery, they are going to have a Lightning wallet. They are going to have an on-chain address. And they are actually going to have to make some transactions and interact with the network. So I've just kind of like onboarded you to Bitcoin and made you use it by kind of encouraging you to try and win a prize. So, you know, that gets me excited and I think could be a lot of fun. So, yeah, I just, you know, well, I'll tell you as well what we're going to do with it next, right? So we ran this thing in the Balkans. And what I'll do, I'll send you the link as well to that website, because the website's still live. The lottery's finished, right? But you can go and read about it, how it works, and you can look at the verifiable results as well. And if you're a bit nerdy, you can go through the results and you can prove that it was a fair draw and that we paid the right people and that sort of thing. But at the moment, I don't know where we're going with this, man. Like, we are just doing it for the love of it, right? So the next one, if people want to get involved, I'm going to try and build more liquidity so we can open it up a bit more to more people. But I'm going to BitFest in Manchester, a Bitcoin conference. And I don't know about you guys, but like, you will have noticed that we're having a little bit of a problem with free speech in the UK at the moment, right? So man, I'm gonna spin up a lottery and try and stick it to Keir Starmer, right? We're gonna run in November the free speech Bitcoin lottery. We're gonna try and sell a bunch of tickets, and we're gonna try and raise money for some free speech organizations in the UK to fund them better so that we can hopefully stop this dystopian issue, right? And maybe just raise some awareness for it. So yeah, I think there's so many interesting ways you could deploy this. I mean, Andy will probably kill me for saying this, but I'm trying to convince him as well. Like, what if the Bitcoin way had like a golden ticket lottery where if you win, you get a hardware wallet, a node, and we fly you out to Panama and get you a second citizenship, right? Like Willy Wonka, golden ticket, right? Escape clown world with the, you know, I have all these crazy ideas, but at the moment I'm just quite having a lot of fun. Like, man, you know, maybe we'll go to a few events have approached us and said, do you want to run a lottery at our event? I'm like, yeah, do you have a good cause to support? Let's go and do it. It's just a lot of fun. And look, if I could get on Bukele's radar and try and do a huge one, man, I would be so excited. But we didn't do this to make money. And do you know what? It's so fun, because when you build something where the motive isn't profit, it kind of takes a little bit of the pressure off. You can just make it pure and have fun with it. You know, Samson Mao, if you're listening, by the way, this thing runs on an API. So when you're out there trying to like orange pill governments, well, man, listen, we could fit this thing straight into any website, any mobile app. Right. So Aqua Wallet could have a built-in Lightning lottery. And with the swaps that you guys do in the background, maybe people could enter the Bitcoin lottery with dollars, right? Like, let's do some real speculative attacks on fiat. And maybe that helps get more governments onboarded, which should be careful with that, right? I'm not a big fan of governments, and I would rather they were nowhere near it, if I'm honest. But you know, I think if we someone's going to do this. It seems too obvious that they wouldn't at this point. So yeah, I don't know where we're going with it, but we're going to have a lot of fun. And if people want to follow along and play some lotteries, we're never going to try and extract value. I'm not your typical Bitcoin influencer. I'm not trying to sell you anything. I'm not trying to shill you anything. just trying to have fun, man.
So you're not going to go public and start chilling stocks or anything like that?
No, man. Like, I want to prove, like, oh, people say, oh, Bitcoin can't be used for small payments. I'm like, here, buy a lottery ticket for $1. Shut up, right? That's nonsense. You know, and people saying, oh, Bitcoin isn't money. I'm like, no, use it. Spend your Bitcoin. And by the way, if you want to enter a Bitcoin lottery, you can't do that with MicroStrategy stock. And you can't do it with ETF shares. The only way you can play the Bitcoin lottery is if you actually use Bitcoin as money. So I kind of get a kick out of the fact that like it demonstrates that Bitcoin is money as well. So yeah, it appeals to the early Bitcoiner in me that like maybe it shows what's maybe possible. I don't know.
Yeah, dude, it's so cool. I love it. So is there anything we haven't talked about on the lottery that you feel like we need to mention? I've got some of the notes we talked about. You know, I think it sounds like an awesome tool for orange pilling. It's sort of like I did this presentation a couple weeks ago, and I was trying to figure out like, okay, how do I close this out? Like, it's a bunch of people who have no familiarity with Bitcoin or very, very limited at most. And I was like, oh, I'm gonna just offer to, like, every one of the 50 people in this room, download a wallet. I'll send you some sats. And I was like, this is like a way of like getting them engaged, right? And one person, and she was already a Bitcoiner. One person came up and was like, so either my discussion was not compelling and that's on me, or to your point, we're just still very early. But I think this is one of those things that, like, I imagine for like a bunch of guys hanging out with their friends and like they haven't been able to get them orange pill. It's like I'm telling you to like put a couple bucks into the lottery. Like that's a way cooler way of, you know, than, hey, read the Bitcoin Standard, start reading Rothbard, right? Like those things are, again, to your points, that they're bigger hurdles to get people over. So I think it's awesome. Is there anything that we haven't touched on that you think's important?
No, not really. I think that's it in a nutshell. You know, so many people, right, they get dragged into these exchanges, right? And then, you know, because some people might take an issue with lotteries, and I understand they're like, they don't like gambling and all that sort of thing. But what I would say about that is, look what everyone's doing now. It's like Weimar Germany, right? Everyone's speculating on everything. It's absolutely crazy, buying Fartcoin and God knows what other nonsense. You know, there is an XRP element. I guess. Well, your favorite coin, man. Yeah. I think what's nice, okay, there's maybe like a slight element of gambling, but what I would say is, like, you know, a lottery is a one-off thing, right? And it runs for 2 weeks, and there's not flashing lights constantly asking you to buy more tickets, and you don't win or lose instantly and don't get that instant hit of dopamine. And you know, maybe we can use it for good causes and all that sort of thing. And yeah, I just love the idea that, I mean, I have this crazy idea, man. Like, I really love animals. So at some point I'm going to do a lottery that supports some dog charity, right? Basically is an excuse for me to go and spend a day with 50 dogs and roll around and just have the best day of my life, right? So yeah, it's just a bit of fun. And you know, I'm kind of willing, like, any brands or anything want to do anything interesting, support good causes, then yeah, like, why not start a lottery, find a good cause you like, and you can sponsor it, and the prize pot could start at one Bitcoin. How crazy would that be? I don't know who's got a marketing budget that big, but yeah, you know, like, maybe we can do some cool stuff. So yeah, no, I think we've done it to death.
Awesome. Any other projects you've got upcoming?
Well, we've got ideas on ideas on ideas, some of them good, some of them probably not so good. But look, you know, my wife's away to introduce a new little hodler into the world in about 8 weeks. So after the November free speech lottery, I might be a little bit hard to reach for a while because, man, I mean, you know, I know you know what I'm talking about, but I'm not going to miss a thing. Actually, I've told all of my clients except the Bitcoin way that, you know, I still work with, that, like, I'm uncontactable. So basically all I'm going to be doing is writing the Bitcoin way newsletter, doing all the socials for the Bitcoin way. But apart from that, you're going to find it hard to get hold of me because I'm not missing anything about that. I'm so excited.
Good, man. Yeah. Congratulations again. And you're going to have so much fun. This is going to be an interesting kid to, I can't wait to like meet your kid when he's, you know, 10 years old and to hear what, you know, like it's going to be like, I don't know, just some sort of Rothbardian crazy, you know, Bitcoin baby. Like I think it's going to be a blast. So it's excited for you on that. I think
my biggest challenge, Michael, is I'm currently trying to wear my wife down and convince her that we shouldn't register the birth with the state, but I'm not getting so far with that at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, that's a negotiation, I imagine, not something that she just rolls over on. So, hey, we covered everything I want to cover in terms of the lottery. I've got a few more minutes. Would you want to just like sort of talk about everything going on in Bitcoin? Because we sort of started the show with like what Bitcoin was like in 2013. We've got like everything. So we've got gold's running crazy. And I think that's a signal to the world as to what's going on, what people are sniffing out. We've got treasury companies. Everyone's talking about them. They're in the tank right now, which is, you know, kind of amusing for me to watch, at least. I don't know what you think. You can share your thoughts. I don't know. We like lending products, a lot of like the financialization of Bitcoin that, like it or not, probably a lot of inevitabilities in the meantime is fiat still our, you know, our paradigm in which most people operate. Is there, if you want to choose your own adventure, is there anything in particular you find most fascinating right now that we should chat about?
Well, I'm going to swerve the core v knots debate because in 5 minutes we won't do that justice. And I'm also not the guy, right? Like that's a, oh man, I don't even know where to start with that debate. But yeah, like let's talk about treasury companies, right? I think they are this cycle shitcoin. I just say it. You know, every single time over the last 12 years that I've heard people say, don't buy Bitcoin, you can outperform it with X, right? Insert shitcoin, insert NFT, insert ICO, whatever. It tends to not end so well. Now, look, so, you know, I know that might upset people. Some people like might not be particularly popular, but look, you know, we're back to that place of counterparty risk again. And actually, you still don't own any Bitcoin. You own no claim over the Bitcoin that company holds, right? That's the bottom line. And we're moving into a world where Bitcoin is the denominator. The scorecard is now measured in UTXOs. And if you don't have any, that's a problem. So, you know, I mean, look, MicroStrategy, for example, huge first mover advantage. And if that became the largest company in the world because it owns 3.5% of the Bitcoin supply, that wouldn't surprise me, right? It seems quite logical. But I'll share something from like the UK Bitcoin situation is the Smarter Web company. Right. You gotta be winding me up, right? So I've always been in digital marketing, all this sort of stuff. I used to run an agency that made websites for people and did digital marketing, SEO, all of that. You know, this is a company, their registered office address, which by the way, Daniel Prince pointed out, their registered office address is like a serviced office mailbox setup, which is just bonkers to me. They make websites starting at a price of £750. Man, I hate to rag on people, but I'm quite frustrated. But like I've checked out their websites, not particularly impressed. They're nothing to write home about. And here's the thing: like people were genuinely full porting their entire pension into Smarter Web Company when it was trading at like $7, $8, $9 a share. Today is 75 cents a share. So there are people out there, Bitcoiners, who I get it, right? You couldn't put your money into Bitcoin, right? Because it's trapped within this pension wrapper. But you just took your whole pension or a big part of it and placed a bet on a web design company that has about 9 employees just because they're buying Bitcoin. Man, that for me, that's as crazy as it sounds. And you know, since then, what have I seen from that company? They're going to the digital asset summits. They're talking about digital assets a lot. Man, I just don't buy it. I think like this is all just another distraction. And I get that your money might be locked up in a pension. Honestly, I'm going to get shot for this, but I would put it into gold before I put it into Bitcoin treasury companies, right? Because like, who the hell are these guys? You know, they could mismanage the company. They could lose the Bitcoin. The counterparty risk is crazy. And you would have never put your pension into a web design company before, but just because they talk about Bitcoin, you're going to place a huge bet on them, man. I think that's crazy. And I also think, look, I have some money in a pension, quite a lot of it's in MicroStrategy, right? So, you know, only because it's locked up, and I bet on the MicroStrategy because it's the biggest beast in the game. But I don't pay into a pension anymore, right? I only gamble with that on MicroStrategy because it's already locked up, but I don't pay any money into a pension now because Bitcoin exists. And, you know, you don't need a financial advisor to basically use the Bitcoin piggy bank. A five-year-old could work this out. You take your money, you put your Bitcoin into cold storage, and you save it. And it keeps going up in value, so you do quite well. You don't need to pay a financial advisor any percentage of your wealth to do that, because Satoshi made saving for your future so simple. So yeah, I get really frustrated with, like, if I hear the word MNAV one more time, Michael, I am going to lose my mind. My God. Dude, I want to talk about UTXOs. I want to talk about silent payments. I want to talk about coin joins. I want to talk about freedom, right? Like, miss me with all this nonsense. I mean, I was at a conference just recently, and man, we were sitting down to a nice dinner, and then the guy, he actually has like an interesting Bitcoin business that does some stuff that I quite like. I was quite interested in it. And then, you know, within half an hour, he's like, oh yeah, and then we're going to launch a treasury company. I was like, oh my, kill me. Right? Like, jeez, please stop. So treasury companies, it's kind of boring. Exhausting. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, well, no, it's not. I disagree. It's not boring. There's fireworks, man. Have you seen some of these charts? Dude,
David Bailey, it's man, like, David Bailey, listen, if David Bailey shields you anything, just run away. The guy is absolute, like, man, he will get you wrecked faster than the hacker that got hold of my Bitcoin, right? I promise you that.
Yeah, man, Jim Cramer vibes. Yeah, it's I felt the same way. So, like, I'm not going to make predictions about what these treasury companies are doing 5 years from now, because I'll probably be eating my words. But in principle, everything you just described is exactly how I feel. Like, maybe Smarter Web Company is crushing it a few years from now, and it's thanks to their Bitcoin treasury strategy. Maybe. But it is completely speculative. This is a completely new domain that we have. You might have good reason to believe that those are going to massively outperform, and it's going to be this real prudent investment, and you were just ahead of the curve on all of it, but also maybe not. And I think that's what frustrates me about the way that they're talked about, is if you are a professional investor with lots of funds and you're going to save a bunch in Bitcoin, and you're like, hey, with 20% of my wealth, 40%, whatever, I have a lot of conviction in these things because of these fundamentals that I like. Awesome. Have fun. Go buy Smarter Web Company and, you know, gamble away. What I see on X is I see normal people, Bitcoiners, many influencers too. And they're that it's not that they're shilling these companies necessarily, but they are like feeling the FOMO, like, oh, I should have bought in. And it's like, no, you shouldn't have. The fact that you didn't buy in means you weren't one of the early investors who knew what the hell was going on. I happen to know a bit about these people in many cases, to where I know that they're not professional investors and shouldn't be recklessly gambling on some stock of a company that they've never read a quarterly report for.
Crazy, like, man. And like I said, you know, over the 12 years I've been here, I've seen so many influencers come and go. I think I'm actually quite good at pointing out the ones that I think won't be here in a while. And, you know, you're seeing a lot of podcasters now getting jobs at Bitcoin treasury companies and shilling them. And, you know, like you said, maybe some of these companies will bounce back and outperform. But if you put your money into a Smarter Web Company at the top, you need a 10x just to break even. That's where we're at. So, you know, man, slay your heroes, right? Like, just because someone on a podcast talks about it, or because it's pumped really hard, like, ignore that FOMO. I like Bitcoin because, well, look, this is part of the reason I didn't completely give up, is because Bitcoin is a guaranteed win, right? Like, if I just work hard, right, do a good job, like work with some good companies, earn a good living, and I save a decent percentage of that in Bitcoin, then I know that in 10 or 20 years from now, I'll have built myself a really nice life. So it's actually becomes easy to like cut out all of this noise and stop speculating and running around and gambling. And I think the biggest heinous thing that these influencers are doing is, whenever these people are getting obsessed with treasury companies, guess what they're not doing? They are not working on their skills. They are not improving their self-custody. They are not improving their online privacy. They are being completely distracted from the things that will guarantee that they're successful in the future. And that's the problem for me. That's the big problem, because a lot of people are just going to make crazy mistakes because they weren't spending their time. That's what they're stealing from you, is your time and your attention.
I think that's well said. Well, Rick, I got to run here to another call here in just a couple minutes. So is that your unpopular opinion, or do you have something else that you want to share?
No, I think that's it, man. Yeah. Just, yeah, treasury companies are shit coins. Good luck. Hey, listen, I don't mind. If you make a load of money, I'm really happy for you. Just remember that Bitcoin is how you take profit. So, you know, if that's what you want to do, just do not wake up 5 years from now with no UTXOs, because, man, you'll be mowing my lawn.
Well said, man. Hey, why don't you tell people where they can find you, and then we'll hang it up for the day.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at rmessit. That's R-M-E-S-S-I-T-T. I'm sure it'll be in the notes. And check out the BTC Balkans website if you want to check out just how the lottery worked. And stay tuned for November. And if you come and play the free speech lottery with me and give a good kicking to Keir Starmer, I know some guys over the pond, we are struggling. We could use a little bit of that freedom that you guys love so much. If you could help me out with that, that would be amazing. And yeah, hope to speak to you guys soon.
Love it, man. We'll link to all that in the show notes. Greg, always so fun catching up with you, man. Thanks for taking time. We'll be in touch soon.
Cheers, Michael. It's always fun, man.
Cheers. And that's a wrap. Again, hope you enjoyed my conversation with Rick. Go check out everything he is doing. And of course, do me a huge favor. If you're enjoying this podcast, this channel in general, give us a like, subscribe, comment, share it with someone who you think might be interested. Anything to feed the algorithm, we would really appreciate. And of course, if you need help with taking proper 100% self-custody of your Bitcoin, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We'll walk you through how we help, our process, everything you need to know. I think you will absolutely love our process. As a former client turned employee, I can attest to it. And we also help with cybersecurity. We have Plan B residency options. We have privacy phone set up for those of you in tyrannical jurisdictions. You're going to want to look into that. Again, it's thebitcoinway.com/podcast, where you can schedule a free 30-minute consult with our team. Until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.